We have Rob Schmidt, who is a teacher at the Thai Meditation Center, which is the owner of this store here. He's one of the founders of the store, and he has been teaching at the Thai Meditation Center for 20 years?
Well, like more, but yeah, that's okay. That's
20
enough.
Plus years.
That's enough.
Which is a tradition rooted in the fourth way of Gurdjieff. And I've been coached about how to pronounce his name this week.
Gurdjieff.
And tonight, Rob will be talking about the mystery of Cupid's arrow, karma, divine love, and co-meditation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you all for coming tonight. Delightful to share this space with you tonight. And we'll see what we can co-create in as much love together as we can womp up here. About 30 minutes ago, I was actually getting dressed in the gym here in town that I go to, and I asked someone who was there, who I see regularly. I have, you know, light little conversations with him as we're, you know, preparing to or have finished with working out. And I said, "How are you doing?" And he informed me that his wife had just died unexpectedly of a brain tumor last month, which was, this is the first day he'd been back at the gym. And it was quite surprising to me. So since I never prepare these talks anymore, I used to do that, but my teacher never thought, in fact he strongly advocated against doing any kind of preparation whatsoever for a spiritual talk. That is, it's supposed to arise out of the moment, out of the time, the place, and the people, and your own connection to divine love. This is something, an impression that I thought I'd share with you tonight, because it seems to me that the title, which I'd forgotten, has the word karma in it. And there's a karmic reminder for us that the love that we can share on this plane has a span. No matter how profound it is, no matter how deep and nourishing and wonderful, or shallow and trivial, whatever, it has a span. And that's a good place, perhaps, to start. Because in one sense, you could make antonyms. That is, you could make the words karma and divine love mean something essentially, roughly, opposite. That is to say that karma speaks of things like the limited span that we have here in these bodies together, the limitations that we have in terms of how many people we could possibly love with a body and through a body in the span of a life of this body's, this organism's lifetime, as opposed to something that I would posit as infinite for all practical and impractical purposes, that is, divine love. So it's good to start with something embodied, because that's where we are. That's what we need to take into account as we seek to embody, as we seek to touch, to contact, whatever aspect of divine love we can get our greasy little mitts on. And I don't mean grasping in the sense of holding on to, of course, because it's something that could never be subject to that kind of treatment. But nevertheless, we have greasy little mitts. In one sense, that's most of what we are. These grasping organisms seeking food, seeking attention, seeking approval. Sometimes we mistake love for attention. I'll suggest for your consideration that those might be two separate things, but we'll maybe touch on that further as we go along. We need to start in these bodies. And so that's where love starts. And I'm not intending on creating actually a hierarchy of love in some kind of rigorous or formal way. But I do want to suggest that the love that we usually embody can be deepened actually through the use of the body. That is to say, that sometimes there is an implicit idea out there, or understanding, that there is something that is often labeled a soul or something like that, that is immaterial, non-material, not of this plane in some essential way. And that is different in nature than these bodies. And maybe there's something to that. But if that soul has incarnated or has some kind of connection with these bodies, then what I'm going to suggest for your consideration is one way to view our task is to look at it as trying to bring the qualities of that immaterial realm into the material plane. And one way to look at that is through love, through the connections that we can potentially make with one another. There are many connections that we can make. They are not just physical plane connections, but they include physical plane connections. So that's the first thing that I want to emphasize here. The more, I won't say romance, but the more physical connection, loving physical connection that we can bring into our lives and embody moment by moment in our affairs with others, that is to say, in the way we treat other people, then that's bringing, to some extent, that non-material aspect, that immaterial, that soul aspect, if there is one. I'm leaving a discussion about the reality of the soul aside here for the Buddhists in the audience, but I don't have a view about the essential nature of souls. I don't think we need to make that assertion. Or I need to make that assertion. But if there is something, one of my teacher's teachers calls it the non-phenomenal realm. And if there is a non-phenomenal self that attempts to connect with this body and to gain impressions of the material plane through this body, well, one of the most potent forms of impressions are the ones with physical connection of bodies. So let's celebrate that connection. We just spoke of its transience. That is one quality that has. It can also have greater or lesser degrees of intensity. And the key to intensifying any experience is to put more attention on it. So if we're going to hang out in a body and try to pull in or allow in the manifestations of this non-phenomenal realm, then what do we need to do? We need to pay attention. And it's not just to this body. Maybe it's to the bodies of those people that we have contact with. So that's sort of a preliminary statement of where I'm coming from tonight, at least. Is we want to get in these bodies to observe everything about, for me, for this organism, but as well, my connection with this organism. And perhaps the non-phenomenal self that is associated with it and with this one, this one, this one, etc. So that's, to me, an interesting and challenging task, and one that will help us perhaps understand how people come together and why people come together in the ways that they do, which is one of the things that I noticed I read just a few minutes ago. That's what I said in the description. So I wouldn't want to, you know, mislead you about what we're going to talk about, but I'd forgotten. So questions, comments at this point before we go on? Wow, you're all with me.
Oh. Why is it necessary for there to be a separation between the outside and the inside, as though something comes within or comes in?
I think that that it is an artificial distinction. I would agree with you that there is no necessity for there to be such a distinction, but I will suggest that most of us, after a certain age, from babyhood on, pretty much experience life in those terms. And one of the things that meditation allows us to do is to start to play with and ultimately dissolve those boundaries or distinctions. So that's part of why I brought up this final point that just a moment ago, not the final point for the talk, but the final point for that part of the talk.
That, I didn't mean to get ahead.
Yeah, no. It's a good question. But that's kind of the deal here, is we want to be able to not identify with any particular distinction. But the distinctions that exist have arisen in this form. They feel real, more or less, to these organisms as we inhabit them and create them moment by moment. So we also need to pay attention to those aspects as well, while also keeping our gaze sort of two simultaneous forms of attention. Let's put it this way. A narrow focus on what's going on moment by moment within the normal purview, but also a sort of broad focus to let stuff that isn't within that normal span into our attention, the range of our attention as well. Does that make sense?
Is that an approach? I understand.
Okay. So that's the way I would, cognize it. Does that respond to your question?
No, it's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
How would you put differently your first remarks if mm-hmm. you were speaking to a tribe of indigenous people who mm-hmm. had no contact particularly with Western civilization?
The whole of my initial remarks, you mean?
Well, no, essentially coming down to the point of the relationship between maybe self and body and soul mm-hmm. and focusing in that area.
Well, it would depend actually on about what I knew about the belief systems of whatever group it happened to be. An awful lot of groups have beliefs in some kind of non-material realm. In fact, I'm not aware of any off the top of my head that don't have some such form of belief. That obviously there's enormous variety mm-hmm. between the different, different systems and worldviews.
Is that seen as somewhere else other than here, that non-material realm?
I think that's how people would see it, but I can imagine. I actually, when I was doing my PhD research, I actually had occasion to look at a lot of material about hunter-gatherer groups over the last couple of centuries all around the world, and there's a lot of variety about how what I'm calling the non-phenomenal realm or the non-material plane or something like that would manifest. In some groups, they might see the spirits of animals as being sort of a primary locus for influences or way to understand influences that include the material but do not end with the material. And in a way, that's kind of what I'm arguing for here too. We're actually, in many ways, kind of hobbled by our, belief systems, in the sense that we're very insistent. Most of us have grown up and been taught to be very insistent on belief in only what you can see. Although you could argue that too, the way that's actually created, is constrained and has all kinds of assumptions behind it in the way it operates. But I don't think it particularly matters, personally, which one of these, systems you go with. We're stuck with the one we share more or less, and those of us with different upbringings have different takes on it. Some of them, might be Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, who knows, or secular. But in any event, whatever the particular amalgam, that's kind of not the point to me. I'm trying to suggest that there's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio, as Shakespeare put it. So, and that's a succinct way to say that we need to pay attention to stuff that goes beyond what we normally pay attention to be able to get to this divine love, whatever that is. So let's talk about what divine love might be. How can we embody divine love in these organisms? My teacher used to say that the only way that a relationship can prosper and grow is if the two parties are each trying to be more generous, slightly more generous to the other member of the relationship than they are to themselves. That is 51% going towards each other. If each is only doing 49% on average, then that relationship eventually isn't going to cohere in a certain important kind of way. And I think there's a truth to this. Any relationship, and every relationship, at least as I've experienced it, necessarily involves compromises. You move in with someone, and suddenly an enormous chunk of your time and energy and attention has to be devoted to the habits, the perceived needs, and perhaps the real needs of the person that you're hanging out with, to a greater or lesser extent. And if we are giving 51% towards them, towards compromise, as opposed to 49%, it can work. So I'm going to suggest for your consideration that is one elementary step in the direction of understanding how we can embody divine love. It's as simple as that. Now, there's also a book recently published by Jacob Needleman whose title is appropriate here, and it is Why Can't We Be Good? Right? Why can't we be good? And the answer is because we have all kinds of compulsive habits and tendencies that act as obstacles to us being good. So sometimes the karma that we have allows us to have to muster that 51% with relative ease with a particular person. With other people it wouldn't work because of our karmic tendencies. But with one particular person at one particular time, yeah, great. And things work swimmingly, relatively speaking. But if it's another person, because our habits and tendencies are dependent entirely upon context, it might not work so well. So this is a prescription for a taste of divine love. What I'm going to further suggest for your consideration is that actually moving further in the direction of divine love means that we actually compromise with other people or the universe more generally, 51%, as opposed to just one particular person. And maybe if we follow the ideas of some of the Indians and Hindus, we might become divine slaves of this love that permeates the universe. And maybe it's so, maybe even 51% then isn't enough. Maybe you're just doing what you're told as much as you can, as much of the time as you can, with as much intensity as you can, more and more and more. But that's not something we can do, I'll assert for your consideration once again, just in the way that we find ourselves with our current habits and tendencies. So how do we start to move in this direction? I want to suggest that we try an experiment tonight. I want to suggest we try this meditation that's mentioned in the title of this talk. It's called co-meditation. It's a two-person meditation form. And the way it works is very simple. We will pair up into pairs and sit as close to each other without touching. Sit and establish eye contact with each other and try not to project any emotional tone with the expression of the face, gestures, anything. The goal is simply to be present with another person and not project an agenda with that other person. To simply be present. When we establish eye contact, maybe that's a window to something important in that other person. Maybe even a window to something in that other realm we spoke of a moment ago, the non-phenomenal realm. So, it's simple. Pair up, move your chairs around. If you came with a couple, if you came in couple tonight and you want to stay in couple, please do that. But if not, just pick a partner. You guys could go. Let me get you a chair. Okay, so now we've done that meditation now for a few moments. So, any comments, questions, observations about it?
It was neat.
Very remarkable. In what way?
Well, actually, I was thinking about the relationship between divine love and the offer of presence. Mm-hmm. Offer of presence. And I'm wondering if divine love might be a little bit more selfish than you're suggesting. Like a star shines, and it's giving totally, completely, but all it's doing is it's consuming its own energy with with this wonderful efficiency. So I wonder about the relationship between the efficiency of consuming the energies that are available to us,
mm-hmm.
and the expression of love. When you're consuming, that's kind of like selfish.
Okay.
So it's like giving, but it's kind of just melting into the bigger picture, the picture of the whole,
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I would say that one of the things that's remarkable about this meditation, and I've been doing it now for more than 30 years, is that, in fact, it's not that you've got a sun and a satellite, but you've got two suns. Right? In other words, both are giving and receiving attention simultaneously. And that's kind of unusual. So, in its purest form, that's what this meditation does. And I will suggest that, in fact, one of the reasons that it's hard for us to imagine divine love is in its vastness it seems untouchable. But I'm suggesting for our consideration and discussion here, based on your very brief introduction to this practice, that this is a way to start or get an apprehension of, a little taste of, what divine love might be like. Divine love does not pick and choose. When you're sitting there giving attention to another person in this way, you are not picking and choosing, to the extent that you're not projecting your own personal agendas of picking and choosing on the other person. You are simply present with that other person, no matter what they are doing, saying, thinking, feeling, etc. And so that's a little bit like the qualities of divine love as we can imagine them in these minds and bodies that we have here. That's what I'm suggesting for you. That's why we do this practice of co-meditation at Tayu. And it's enormously illuminating of just that thing. So I thank you for pointing out this both consumption and radiation aspect. That's exactly right, and it's happening simultaneously for both partners in this co-meditation practice. And that's very cool. So thank you. Other comments, questions, observations? Yeah.
I noticed that at the beginning I felt very separate, and then as it went on I felt that go away.
Mm-hmm.
So felt more just the non-separation of that being with someone who I didn't know at all, and there was calm in that. And that just happened in that short amount of time. It was really, really nice.
Thank you. That's a very acute comment. There's you know, we have all kinds of buffers, what in the fourth layer are called buffers, that is sort of habits that keep other people in the universe in general at bay. And they are mostly our own projections. And so when we first meet someone, almost always the way that we're, our habits are entrained, the way that we're trained informally, and formally to some extent, establishes those and maintains them, and we incorporate those as habits in our lives. But when we establish eye contact with someone else, it puts things into a different space, because there is a quality about eye contact, especially when we're attempting not to project an agenda onto another person, there's a quality about eye contact that cuts through these habits and tendencies. You know, my teacher used to point out how eye contact has, in many cultures, been regulated, actually by law, in some cases, or, and in many cases, informally. But, like, you know, in many medieval contexts, both in East and West, if a commoner raised his or her eyes to someone in the elite class, that could be cause for immediate beheading or some other you know, gruesome punishment. Because it also implies what set you at ease, which is this equality, this sense of lack of separation, or the dissolving to some extent of the usual senses of separation. So, thank you. That's really important. There's a few people here tonight who've been doing these exercises for many years, and you know, we have a group of them, and these are the ones. This basic one is the you know, the sort of the fundamental building block. But there are many, many iterations where we actually explore how the how our habits in the midst of daily life in relationship generate agendas and buffers and screens and attacks and this and that, simply out of automatic habits that we've incorporated into ourselves. And we can use this basic exercise, incorporating speech and other things, but still maintaining this basic co-meditation space, to systematically examine those habits so that we don't have to compulsively forever manifest them, so that we actually let them go eventually, at least some of them. It takes time, obviously, because we've built up these habits over decades. Yeah.
Well, having done this for a few minutes, I don't know what exactly would happen, but I have made eye contact many times and know that at some point in time, at least two things happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very interesting. It's like looking at, it's kind of like candle meditation, like concentration, bringing you back to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What I wonder about, and since you've been doing it so long, perhaps can shed some light on it, no pun intended there, but if you're looking at someone for a while, what can happen is I'll just glaze over, or the other person glazes over.
Mm-hmm.
The other phenomena where you look like you're doing the eye contact is the steely gaze.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, you're not really making eye contact. Your eyes are pointing in the right direction.
Yes.
But could you talk about those phenomena a little bit and how you work with that kind of dullness of consciousness?
Sure, absolutely. Those are very good questions, and those are the sorts of things that necessarily arise and people have to deal with as one becomes more accomplished in this particular meditation and its many iterations. But you know, the first comment I'll make is that the thing about the steely gaze is actually it's you know, I certainly went through that phase. You know, I think most people end up doing that. It's one way that the ego tries to do what it thinks it's supposed to do. You know, but actually, what we want in this meditation is a relaxed gaze. So,
how do you recognize it? How do you work with it?
Yeah.
How do you realize that that's what you're going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like anything else. It takes a little time. It doesn't take
skill.
Yeah, it's just cultivating skill, but it's not really it's not rocket science. And when we do these in a context, you know, a group context, we do, you know, workshops and stuff like that with it, then you get feedback, because we talk, you know, after each time we'll get feedback. So we will share feedback either with just the other person, if you're just doing it with another person, or you share feedback with a whole group of people, and it's like that can be very illuminating about just this sort of thing. So and then there's all kinds of things that can arise in terms of it's sort of like learning to ride a bicycle. You know, at first you're tipping one way, and then you're tipping another way, and then eventually you get your balance, and sometimes you tip because something happens, but you right yourself pretty quickly. So it's like that. One of the things that you can eventually do when you get good at this sort of meditation is to do it in the midst of daily life when no one else knows that you're doing it. That is, you are giving attention to the people that you meet at a level of intensity that they have no idea that you're doing. No idea. And you'll find that people can find that immensely nourishing without knowing why, without knowing what the hell's going on, without knowing why they feel the way they do about this exercise, without having a clue, really. But they just know that it opens channels that are not usually open. Most of us, you know, most of the time we are pretty constrained. Our opportunities for genuine contact, for clarity of contact, are fairly restrained by our habits, not by law, but by habit. And so getting better at them, getting better, that is to say, at giving attention in a certain kind of way, actually, you know, the universe is, there are some principles that seem to work. And one is that if I give, I receive. So if I give people attention, real attention, without agenda, guess what? The universe has to pay me back for that in a certain kind of way. It isn't necessarily in the same way with people, one individual, giving me attention, although that can be wonderful. So when we're in committed relationship or exploring committed relationship with one individual, using this kind of tool is a great way to see where it can go, how deep it can go, in a non-threatening way, or mostly non-threatening. People can be afraid of eye contact, very, very afraid of eye contact. There are even people who are afraid to look into the eyes of a baby, afraid that the baby's going to see them. Because the baby doesn't, we all know this thing about babies, they can't lie. They look in your face and they like what they see or they don't. And people who are afraid that they don't like that they are unlikable, or who don't like themselves to a greater or lesser extent, can be quite afraid of looking into the face of a baby, because it's scary. They're scared of what kind of reaction is going to happen, even a baby. So even more so, in some ways, with someone that we let our guard down with slowly. That is, someone in a more or less committed relationship. It's tough stuff.
Babies like to approach you rather than be approached. So until a baby invites you to come on, you're probably you're inviting kind of rejection. To just go on up to a baby. Usually, that's how babies work.
In a certain kind of way, I would agree with that. But actually, my experience has been that if that's only true if you're imposing your presence in a way that is not necessarily frightening, but kind of like unexpected. But babies cycle like everyone else, and so if they if they're in a receptive mode, they're happy for that, you know. But that's true for all of us.
If you want to hold them, then they're like, wait a minute.
Looking. No. This is the kind of attention I'm talking about. Is this eye contact? That's all I'm talking about for right now, at least with regard to, you know, basically an extension of this exercise that we've just done. Yeah.
Just thinking that there was a kind of a keynote in that exercise. It was a wonderful exercise. Thank you, Teresa. Here, I was thinking about the keynote being surrender, and at first. You know, there was that fear at first with the smiles and not being able to make that connection. And I think, and I hesitate to use the word divinity, but I think my idea of divinity changed. It's at once, it's more special, and yet it's less special in the sense that it's very ordinary. But it was only by surrendering. I think there was a certain point, kind of like, I think it was in this movie Contact with Jodie Foster. There was this visual of going through a lot of space, mm-hmm. kind of approaching infinity. And there was a certain scary. There was a fear. But once I surrendered, then it just opened up into.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. That's actually I like that formulation. There is a you touch on two of the qualities of divine love that I think are crucial to understanding or being able to understand it to the extent that we can in these organisms or through these organisms, and that is one that there is this. Vastness, which is so vast to it that it can seem impersonal if you come to it with a particular perspective, but actually is, in another sense, enormously welcoming. So that's on one side. The other side is this particularity. Teresa is utterly unique. At this moment, in fact, she is utterly unique compared to the Teresa that was and the Teresa that may be. So divine love is big enough to encompass that, to appreciate that, and to appreciate all these other people doing the same thing at the same time. And all the other beings paying attention to this enormous multiverse together at the same time. So it's like a, you know, the two sides of a coin. We are the outs, or can't think of a good metaphor here, but we're kind of like the outside face, the individual outside face of a gem, all the facets of a gem, you know, but all the other facets are reflected sort of interiorly to us as well, and present simultaneously. So it's really wonderful. But we have to be willing to pay attention. That is the key thing, as I said earlier. That's the coin of the realm in meditation, in co-meditation, and in coming to familiarize yourself with divine love, as we're formulating it here tonight. Other comments, questions? Yeah.
When we're doing this together, it's more like practice, so that because I understand perfectly what you're saying about being in the world and having these experiences. I've had amazing experiences with people. I mean, just walking to an ice cream parlor and my eyes and then the little woman sitting there connect, and it's so transformative. And it's so transformative that I have to write poetry about it. And it's just like a momentary thing. Mm-hmm. Or my little grandchild is in the bathtub and we actually connect eye contact for 45 seconds and never drop it. And it's just so connecting. But what I'm wondering is, the thing is, it happens so little. You know, mm-hmm. what happens all the rest of the time of our lives?
Mm-hmm.
But is this process that you're talking about, the practice, is that helping you to become more able to have more of these experiences, or always having these experiences? The idea of doing this?
That is, yes. Essentially, that's a big part of it. We're trying to increase the amount of current that we can channel in this realm and in this regard. So when we start out, it might be very stressful at first to be present with another person in co-meditation, in a co-meditation space. And you know, we can usually get through the initial hump, you know, with relative ease, but depending on the individual. But then the challenge is to create not a habit which obstructs us from paying attention, but a habit which reminds us and enables us to pay attention. So this can be conducted in such a way that we, in fact, do that. That we create habits. There's a whole realm of this practice. I mean, I said there are many iterations. There's actually all these sort of different lines that come off of it, and one of them uses speech in such a way as to create some habits of the ways that we interact with other people, so that we are not constantly generating karmic connections with other people, so that in fact we're even eating up karmic connections that we may have generated in the past. And I don't know if we have time to get into that a lot tonight, but that's one of the things that can be accomplished with this sort of meditation. But it's because we're putting attention on the process of being with another person. Sometimes that process...
Thank you.
The process of paying attention is the key thing. And sometimes we're paying attention to one aspect of relationship. Sometimes we're paying attention to another aspect of relationship. Sometimes... There's a way in which you can do co-meditation with the sentient animal world. There's a way, in a sense, you can do co-meditation with the supposedly non-sentient material world. That's another whole area. But the point is basically to be paying attention. And so, in fact, we need to create habits of doing that. Meditation is one form. You know, meditation in its many aspects and many traditions is essentially a way of doing that. This particular form is one that has become central to our path, because we try to do things in the midst of daily life. We try to bring attention to the midst of daily life, and this is a great tool for it, because we're always interacting with people, and usually it's the playing out of mechanical habits of cause and response. You know, this particular cause causes me to, you know, you say that don't you look pretty tonight, and I say, oh yes. And you say, gee, that shirt has a stain on it, and then I go, oh my God, you know, that's an example of the kind of mechanical reactivity. Whereas from the perspective of divine love, thank you, this shirt has a stain on it. Cool. Next time, I'll look and see, and wash it first before I put it on, or something, whatever. It's not a problem. It's simply more data. that has arisen through the practice of paying attention. And we find out things about our own habits and tendencies and the habits and tendencies of the people that we're observing, that we're putting our attention upon. And those habits and tendencies are usually our own to a greater or lesser extent. That is to say, there's almost nothing that anyone here has in their own repertoire of usual responses to life that the rest of us haven't experienced to a greater or lesser extent at some point. So we're seeing ourselves then as well. So thank you. Other comments, questions?
So then presence is a form of divine love.
I firmly am persuaded that that is the truth. So when I started out, I was suggesting that we need to bring divine love into these bodies. And in fact, many forms of meditation that encourage the infusion of presence within the body are thus a form of infusion of divine love in the body. We're putting attention in an area where it hasn't been going. And who better than me to put attention on this body? I mean, it's nice if someone else does, too, but they can never do it with the intensity that I could, just given the way that this space works. So yeah. But we also bring presence to relationship, which you know, when we think about it in the ideational realm, has a certain reality, but it also has a kind of reality in the moment-by-moment realm that we can assign ideationally a form and describe it and so forth like that, but we can also feel it with presence in a certain kind of way that can seem very palpable. For instance, this space that we're all now occupying together, that we have co-created together here, changed materially when you guys did the co-meditation. It really feels different after that. You guys opened up some energy portals or something, and this space reflects that. This space that we're now sharing and co-creating as we converse together. It has a different energetic configuration. And we can sense that in some way that's hard to put your finger on. It's a certain slippery something, as my teacher used to say. Thank you. Thank you. You were going to say something.
Yeah, it seemed like it wasn't caused by any of my intention or thoughts or that arose or anything, but just it seemed more like maybe it was just the amount of time that I just spent like present, you know, with someone. It seemed like after it got past a certain threshold, maybe like halfway through the meditation, maybe it was the time, maybe it was the energy like you're talking about in the room, but I just felt this, you know, without any thoughts or anything, but this really opening of my heart energy happened, and I still feel it right now.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the energy from the room or just the energy from just being with someone for that period of time that we're not usually.
Both, I would suggest. Both. You know, making the effort to pay attention is, in some ways, my teacher's teacher says that that's the one thing that we can do, that the non-phenomenal self can do, read soul, if you will, for that the non-phenomenal self can do through this body that we know is not necessarily contaminated by our own habit, energies, and agendas, that sort of thing. So that feels good. It feels different than our normal experience of life. And that's why, you know, you can get this opening. And that is an experience that we don't want to, well, I don't know, I can't speak for the rest of us, but I want to be able to reproduce at will. I don't want to wait for someone else to do something or something else to happen. I want to do it, or I want to open myself to it, however you decide to look at it. But it's something that is amenable to this focusing of attention that I talked about. And that's why it's so powerful as well. In this way that we're appreciating now. But that we don't usually have access to, because we're sort of caught up in a bunch of habits that pull our attention hither, thither, and yon. In all these unproductive directions in general. So, it's wonderful. It's truly wonderful. And it's the work that I feel I'm here to do in substantial part. And my own view is that if we have a purpose, one way to, as human beings, one way to describe that purpose is to be God's sensory organs. And being God's sensory organs is sort of like bringing this presence of divine love into our lives and using it as a lens of attention for everything that we experience, internally and externally, without discrimination, as Richard was pointing to earlier. So, thank you. Other comments, questions?
How long do you do it in a normal session?
It depends. We have like every other week, and then on weekdays we'll do like 10 minutes at a time.
How long did we just do it?
A couple minutes. But then we also have in the workshops we do sessions that might start out at 2 or 3 minutes, but then we're changing. If it's a group of people, we'll be expressly moving around and doing it with different partners all the time, so you get the different experience with different people, number one, and the different reactions that arise. It's sort of like, you know, when you're walking down the street, there are some people that the tendency is to look away from them, and other people the tendency is to look towards them, right? And even this, and sometimes then even the ones that we have the tendency to look towards, if they look back at us, we'll look away immediately, because we don't want to be seen as being wanting to look towards them. It's not the same as co-meditation, but anyway, the directions that these things go are very informative. So we switch around to look at these, to get a look at these habits, to get familiar with them, to scrutinize them as you know, in the sense of putting attention on them. And so there's different forms, those take different amounts of time. And lately, some of these people have been doing, 20 or 30 minute sessions, but that's involving some speech stuff too. But still, 20, 30 minutes can be a long time if you're not used to it. You have to sort of build up, to be able to do that. You know, the comment earlier by the lady who had to leave was about the eyes glazing over. And that can happen partly because, as with any other skill, it's like you have to build up your strength. And focusing attention in any format or in any realm that you're not used to doing it, you have to build up your strength in that realm.
I'm used to meditating alone, and I usually have like a period of preparation right before I meditate. So mm-hmm. it's like off the starting block into it, and I usually have a chance to say something to the divine. And so as I went in, a little bit I had to say, thank you that my shoulder, I hurt my shoulder swimming yesterday. Thank you that my shoulder isn't hurting right now, so I can maybe concentrate a little bit. Mm-hmm. This quick prayer.
Whatever works to clear the decks is my attitude. We are extremely pragmatic in our approach. That is, we want to use anything that helps us direct our attention in ways that will be productive, that will bring that divine love presence into the organism as fully as possible, which includes the body, the mind, and the heart. The heart being, in some ways, the core. Yeah.
This is Valentine's Day.
It is.
And so there are lower chakras. So as we've been speaking, I assume on a level of like raising bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm.
What is this in this meditation? Does it become just flirtatiousness?
That's a good question. It's my experience is when we do it, in our in the Tayu context where I've done it. It almost never that stuff doesn't come up very much. Not that desire mind doesn't arise, but because we're expressly cultivating this non-agenda place. And that intention drains the energy out of what would be compulsive flirtatiousness, to the extent that someone is serious about going to that place or cultivating, as with anything else. Now,
because lovers do co-meditate.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the ways that they get this connection between them, that they establish a connection between them. And in fact, having sex while you're co-meditating expressly, I can report, is pretty darned hot. Because there is a flow of energy there such that sometimes if you're not coming from that space, if you're coming from a desire, at least for a guy. I don't know how it works for women, obviously. But I assume there's some similarities here. At least for me, there's what will arise is how do I make this feel better, right? But if instead your attention is sort of more broad to include the co-meditation space with its eye contact, at the same time that this energy is invoked and summoned, it actually pulls in a form of the divine presence that is extraordinarily, wonderful, exhilarating, and beyond, way beyond simple desire mind. But I was first addressing the point that anybody can you can walk down the street and look at people and sort of beam your energy desire at them with your eyes. I mean, that's not co-meditation, really. That's just...
It is contact through presence and awareness, even though the desire mind is present. And
yes.
It's not to say that sexual love is not, in some sense, divine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this aspect of the karma that develops out of the attachment.
Yes.
Whereas this meditation seems to arise from as a practice to bring someone perhaps less aware of loving kindness, compassion, divine love,
mm-hmm.
however
mm-hmm.
we want to frame it, into more contact with it in relationship to these higher chakras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that
well, I mean, I guess the way
there's a kind of a gray zone in here where
I would call it a dance.
Dance, okay.
I would call it a dance, and my attitude is that the higher chakras cannot be accessed in a reliable way unless there is full energy flow in the lower chakras, number one. So we have to start with the places where we are. And in fact, desire mind is not something we have to get rid of or eliminate or sweep under the rug or hide or someplace like that. In fact, we need to go there and observe it. It too needs what part of us better needs this aspect of divine love, of presence, than that aspect of us. So that's what I'm saying, is that it is possible to invoke that into the physical sexual space in a way that is extraordinary. That's actually a considerable achievement, of course, but it can be done. And but you start by paying attention to where you are, in all cases, and that means not deciding a priori that divine love made a mistake when it made my genitals, or whatever else our minds decide are obstacles to accessing divine love. And so I'm quite grounded and earthy in my view about this sort of thing. You have to go to the gonads to get to a place where you can then bring that presence, that divine love presence energy, into the full heart space and experience that flowering, which is cool and everything. But all along the way, there can be all kinds of wonderful flowerings too. And just seeing, I shouldn't say just, but seeing the essence of desire mind clearly is a great accomplishment and part of our work here. That's God paying attention to the universe through the lens of this organism in a way that nobody else can do for this organism, which is part of the product of divine love. So, thank you.
Did I understand you just now when you said that for the full opening of the heart that it has to come through the sexual energy? Is that what you said?
Actually,
I would have a question about that myself.
I didn't mean to say that, the sexual energy. I meant to say the body and the mind. Mm. I'm referring to something that in the fourth way, which is where the tradition that Tayu comes out of, there's this idea that there are three basic centers, the body, the heart, and the mind. But then there's these two, Gurdjieff talked about two additional centers, the higher intellectual and the higher emotional center. And opening the higher emotional center, what I would call the heart center, is the true flowering to going into spaces where we can have full access to what you could call the non-phenomenal realm, where those interpenetrate in a complete or a more complete way. But you have to go through the body, and so the body contains all this stuff. I wouldn't characterize it as sexual energy, because that idea has all kinds of connotations and leads us in unproductive directions, I think. Not that there isn't energy that you could label sexual energy, but people who I respect do that. I just don't like that formulation of it, because it I think it tends to reify certain directions and certain habits and tendencies that are hard for us to. This is a very tricky area, and so we want to make it as little as straightforward as possible. So if instead we think about this body, this organism, and think of it in on the body level, and all the energies that it has access to, then sexual stuff is just part of that. You know, it's an impulse that arises, but it's not like my own view is that a lot of the traditions that talk about certain kinds of energies being sexual are actually just referring to particularly strong kinds of energy. They're using a label which in certain systems and contexts makes sense. But if you take it outside that context, which is what we do when we have our bookstore like this, and you take an idea out of this context and stick it into that context, suddenly it has all kinds of, there are all kinds of problems with using it that way. So does that make sense?
Yeah, you said it in a certain way that just seemed opposite to that. That's why I questioned it.
Gotcha.
Because I think when the heart opening that can come instantaneously or with practice or spontaneously mm-hmm. or not, or you find yourself just connected mm-hmm. in this most, you know, to everything that's always here anyway, but we're not always connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's, and there are powerful energies with that, in the connectedness of it,
yeah.
the oneness of it.
Right.
Is that what you were referring to, or it just sounded
generally
like
yes
to come through the sexual, and I thought that
no,
it does not. Anyway,
it has to go through the body, or what I'm saying
body.
More specifically, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to come through the body, mm-hmm. but a reliable foundation for bringing this into ordinary life, moment by moment, must, or most profitably, can be done by bringing it through the body. The body is a huge, huge ally or tool that we can use in this process of bringing divine love into the whole of this organism. So bringing attention to the body is what's going on. I think it's an easy misunderstanding to create because of our all this stuff about sexual energy. You know, all the ideas about sexual energy that are out there, but I'm definitely not saying that we have to I don't know, flip on a sexual energy switch someplace. Not at all. But we have to be present to and observe the arising of all manifestations, including sexual ones. That's all.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Any other comments, questions, observations? Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say that I appreciate your focus on the body, because to me the central fact of human existence is that we show up in a body, and we have this phenomenon of mind and whatever else that seems kind of intangible, but the fact is that we can at least imagine being a discarnate mind, if you will, or a spirit, but we're not. We've got bodies, so let's, you know, if this is what we came for, why not pay attention to it and show up for it?
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. One of the funnier things. I've loved science fiction since I was a kid, and one of the, you know, you might remember the first Star Trek series. There was an episode where there were these little brains and bowls that were talking. You know, they
it's a Steve Martin movie. The Man with Two Brains.
I haven't seen that one, but I always wanted to see it. I love Steve Martin, so I'll have to see that. But let's rent that one. But anyway, but there's this, you know, I don't know if it could ever have arisen before our culture, this idea of brains and bowls, and that's a human being. And all you need is and you stick it in it, and then you stick it in a this robotic body,
yeah.
And all of a sudden you've got a person, right? It's an incredibly narrow. It's an incredibly narrow perspective on human existence. We are these bodies, and at the same time, what we're talking about here, at least what I'm talking about here, is bringing something that is greater than these bodies into the existence of them, and making them part of this greater, these greater energies, making them transparent to and connected with these greater energies. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that ties into, I mean, I like what you were saying earlier about that being God's sensory organs. And lately, I've just had this change in my own thinking. I don't know if I can articulate it well, but it seems to me that there are certain non-material energies that perhaps can only be transformed through the alchemy of the physical body. And that is actually maybe really what our work here is. We're supposed to be transforming this energy.
I could not agree more. I think that's succinctly and wonderfully said. In fact, we have books here in the store from my own tradition that make exactly that point at great length. The alchemy. There's one by a friend, Lee Loswick, called "The Alchemy of Love and Sex," which I guess we have out here for sale. Imagine that here in our bookstore, which make important points. By the way, one of my other favorite books is there on the table I'm seeing, which is "A General Theory of Love," which has nothing to do with the alchemical stuff, but is a wonderful has a wonderful introduction to some of the psychological studies that talk about where we start from as beings, with as mammals, essentially, with the emotional needs of mammals. Mammals need to be seen. They are social creatures. And this is an aspect that we haven't really touched on here. But mammals, in order to grow up and to be normally behaving, successfully reproducing mammals, they actually require enormous amounts of physical and emotional contact when they're growing up and throughout adult life in order to maintain and express normal or even better than normal behavior. And young mammals that don't get that are, as we all know, severely wounded. But that book has a really wonderful discussion of that sort of material. And that's, you know, it's one of my favorites. Haven't seen it in a while, so it was good to see it out there. Thank you. I'm glad you brought that point up, because in fact it is, you know, another way to say that we have these bodies. The purpose of having these bodies is because we can do things with them that we could not do, or that the non-phenomenal self could not do in whatever other realms it hangs out in normally, or, you know, it's has access to. Thank you. Did you want to?
Well, I would on that point, very point, I've come to realize for myself that this physical incarnation has a wonderful aspect to it that it would not if I were an unmanifest intelligence and could just bring anything to existence with my thought, and that is that there is resistance.
Mm. Yes.
And I have to effort in some way to make things happen. So
Thank you. You know, that's a wonderful observation. What it immediately made me think of, science fiction mind that I have, is from the Star Trek Next Generation, there's this creature called Q, who has no limitations. He can do whatever he conceives, and he can make anything happen in the universe. And he's this lonely, miserable son of a bitch who has no fun, who has no possibilities for growth whatsoever, and is stupid in fundamental ways about how this universe, or maybe the greater universe, actually works. So going to a place where there's constant friction, that's the word that my teacher used to love, friction. There's the pleasurable friction of two bodies together. There's the pleasurable friction of two minds together. There's the pleasurable friction of many bodies and many minds interacting in a variety of ways. And there is the pleasurable friction of hearts rubbing together. So that's why we are here. Or another way to say why we're here. Thank you. Any other final... I don't know what time it is, but I'm sensing that this is probably... A good time to close. So, any final comment, question, observation? Well, I want to thank you all for coming tonight. It's been a lot of fun for me. I will point out that we actually have, I don't know if I have any of the flyers here, but actually, normally Taiyu Meditation Center offers workshops in co-meditation for people, but in fact, we're doing something. Stuart was supposed to be here tonight, but unfortunately he's on the East Coast doing business. So, c'est la vie. But he and I will be conducting a co-meditation workshop through the Center for Integral Human Being here in Sebastopol on Saturday, March 8th, coming up. So if you want, see if we got our little pictures here. So if you want any more information about that, you can take a look at these flyers here. If you have any information about, any questions about Taiyu and what we do a little co-meditation every other Sunday morning. I think this Sunday is a Taiyu Sunday Meditation Communion at Taiyu House, about 3 miles south of town. So you can learn more about co-meditation there if you're interested. In the meantime, have a wonderful rest of your Valentine's Day evening. Thank you for sharing yours with me and with each other and co-creating this space together. I have enjoyed it very much.